So, hi everyone, I'm Sonia Busso, Associate Professor in Public Policy at the University of Birmingham. I've long been studying and designing participatory democracy processes, and I use participatory approaches to research and evaluation in my work. And in this conversation for the Deliberative Democracy Digest, we consider how we can create meaningful collaborations with young people for social change. So I'm here with legislative
Congratulations.
theatre expert and award winner Katie Rubin, who uses creative methods to involve in policymaking communities and groups like young people whose voices are too often marginalised, and the CEO of the UK-based youth organisation Youth Focus Northwest, Stu Dunn, was years of experience of working with children and youth, helping bridge the gap between young people and local institutions. And Youth Focus Northwest also supports the Greater Manchester Combined Authorities Youth Assembly, which is a formal body of youth participation in the region. So to begin with, let me say a few words to explain why this conversation. So in the field of participatory and deliberative democracy, democratic innovations, we are seeing more and more initiatives that aim to involve young people in deliberative processes, from citizen assemblies on biodiversity recently in Ireland, or climate change, or race and identity, to participatory budgeting in schools to co-decide with young people how to spend public funds in their schools or their neighborhood. And there is also a long history of co-design and co-production with young people from other fields like health, education, community development. And youth participation has become central in policy discourse, at least in rhetoric, particularly in a context where young people show less trust in democracy than older generation and are increasingly distant from representative institutions. And by the same token, in research, there are more and more calls for grant proposals with a focus on young people. So, how this participation is conceptually and politically linked to empowerment and meaningful opportunity for policy change is a crucial concern, or we might risk exacerbating disengagement. And experts in youth participation, like Professor Laura Londi, also encourage us to acknowledge the subtle power hierarchies between adults and young people that can risk turning their participation into compliance with adult ideals. So it's important to reflect critically on what the ambition for horizontal relations of participatory democracy and participatory research actually means when we collaborate with young people, and how we can create genuinely inclusive spaces without overburdening young participants. And so this brings me to the first question that I would like to reflect on with Katie and Stu. How can researchers, practitioners, and participatory democrats work with young people in a way that is not extractive or places a burden on young people in their community? So how can we prioritize their rights more and better as part of our work?
Thank you very much, Sonia. I suppose I'll kick off if that's okay. I think it's important from the start to emphasize and understand that it's really difficult for researchers and practitioners not to be extractive if we consider the way that funding streams are facilitated, but also how academic institutions and going through the permission process. And to get research, research view through. Much of the design and delivery of participative practices and research with young people is very much prescribed from the start. And I know that there's opportunities to develop that as people go on. But just the sheer way that the systems and structures are set up from the start means that it's probably is less participative than everyone wants, and that's including the researchers. So there's something there about understanding that the aims, the methodology, but also the target group that people are looking to work with is often already prescribed from the beginning. And I know ourselves, Sonia, we've worked with programs and structures where we've not bent the rules, but we've been creative in the time in the kind of the opportunities that we've had that. So I don't think it should be I don't think it's good to say that it's not extractive, but also understanding the nature of research with people is that it is extractive, and it is about working in partnership with people to obtain information from them. So from our experience, it's really important to be open and honest with young people from the beginning, and we often suggest that whenever recruiting young people or working with young people around research or programs is about doing your homework and accessing local services that are already working with children, young people. Much of it is because they already have relationships with the young people, and also the organisations are going to be there once the research finishes. And so it's really important that we think about that exit strategy from the beginning. From the beginning as well. With regards to how can we prioritise children and young people's rights, you mentioned the Laura Lundy model just then in your intro, which is based on children and young people's rights. Just as a real personal point, I think that everyone should be having children, well, young people's rights as a foundation for all the work that they do. And this includes research as well. And maybe there should be information within the ethics or information within terms of funding about how we ensure that children's rights are not only promoted whilst we're working and practicing, but also they're lived and they're part of the practice as well. So the kind of the two go hand in hand actually, around having young people's rights as part of the foundations when working, but then also being open and honest with young people about being extracted as well.
That's great. Just to give a bit of context about Lundy, a research proposes a model for rights compliant children's participation to implement Article 12 of the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. And it's based on four interrelated concepts. Space, so children must be given the opportunity to express a view. Voice, they must be facilitated to express their view. Audience, so the view must be listened to and influenced, and so the view must be acted upon as appropriate. And I think these are four really important principles, but obviously there are a number of ethical dilemmas and challenges in implementing them adequately in the context that we do work and live in, and all the constraints with funding as well. But that was really helpful, Stu. Katie, I don't know if you want to jump in and share from your experience.
Absolutely. I totally agree with everything you said, Stu, and it's sparking some other thoughts. I think I really appreciate what you said at the beginning, that kind of the baseline is that any research is going to be extractive. And so the question then becomes, how are we designing and shaping the project and the communication to be totally transparent, and first of all, and to figure out to allow young people to come into that project, understanding that what's being extracted, right? And then also trying to figure out or be able to adapt that project or that container to the goals that those young people have, right? You're talking about the rights of the child, and part of that is being able to not just express their voice or their opinion, but also have that opinion acted upon. And so I get to this question. Not being an academic or a researcher myself, very firmly being a practitioner, thinking what is being extracted and what is the purpose of it? And where is the research going in terms of the changes that young people and that I and that many practitioners and all of us as colleagues want to see in the world. What's the relationship between those changes that we want to see in the world and the research that's being extracted? And are those directly linked? And therefore, if we're communicating clearly that this is what's being extracted, do young people feel that that has a relationship to the change they want to see in their lives? And then does it really, right? Do they feel it and does it really? So I think this is a challenge that maybe we'll get to later in the conversation too, about being clear about those goals, but then really being humble to think about what is the limitation of research in relation to why young people would enter into a project in the first place. And I guess I always think, if we're going to do a collaboration, trying to change something in the world, we're going to be coming with people who are coming from different places, right? Young people or people who are directly impacted by a social issue. And then you've got decision makers, or let's say, the municipality or the government or the institutional leaders. And then in this case, you've also got researchers who are hopefully, using their learning and analysis to contribute to our understanding of the problem to move something forward. But how can we find a medium spot where everyone, a place in the middle of that Venn diagram where everyone is getting something out of it? And I think that requires a lot of humility on the plate in the role of the practitioners and the researchers to understand the limitations of what they do, which I don't always see. That humility and that understanding. That's one thing. And then the second thing that what you were saying, Stu, about kind of and Sonia about rights and protections. And I think this is really important. And I feel this way, so I think, as you said, Stu, the outline and the questions of the research are often, identified before any young people or even community practitioners are invited on board, A. And then there's this whole ethics process that none of us, by none of us, I mean me, right, understand really, or are invited into, or have the language to really fully contribute to, and the sort of jargon. And then what happens is, in my experience, the young people get this 25-page packet to check all the things that they're happy or not happy to be, extracted from them. And that is meant to protect their rights. And I'll speak for myself. When I fill out those forms, I feel that all of my rights are being extracted by it showing it's defining the power relationship between me and the institution, that they have the power to take my words, my likeness, to do whatever they want with them. And then what, of course, ends up happening is that some researchers go and publish something because that's their requirement, right? Or that's what they committed to do in getting whatever funding or whatever project is happening. And it is supporting their career in their name, in their language that I will say I don't feel comfortable in. And in my experience, young people don't feel comfortable in either. It's a very specific language. It's like a different language, of all the languages in the world to me. So to even have this ethics process that I guess what I'm saying is, if we're thinking about rights, we need to think very carefully about how we're protecting those rights, and the ways that universities have to protect those rights, I feel, aren't doing a good job of creating a space that actually feels safe from an institutional kind of clause for young people or any other participants. I have lots of other thoughts, but I'll leave it there for now.
I think these are really, really important points. And I think we juggle two different systems and two different relationships, right? And often we have to replicate things. And so we have all the lengthy ethics protocol that then we have to translate into shorter documents or conversation to have with the participants. And then I suppose the gap can actually open space for risks to rights, paradoxically. And yeah, and things being missed or overlooked or not highlighted as they should so I agree. And so definitely, there's a lot of work to do in terms of bridging the gap between the institutional requirements and how they have to be changed and adapted in order to meet the ethical commitments of research, participatory research in the community, and particularly with young people.
Just on that, the rights one's always a really interesting one, and as Katie said, the bit for me is the dialogue that happens, because not only are we looking at practitioners, young people, and academic institutions, but you're also looking at the institutions where the research is happening sometimes. So you could be working in a prison, you could be working in mental health, where young people's rights are infringed upon, and some the reasons are for good reasons because of what's to protect their safety. So there's all that kind of complexity that sits behind it as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, if we think less in terms of participatory research and more in terms of these participatory processes and participatory democracy, I wonder if one way of prioritizing young people's rights is to start with their claims. And so instead of identify a policy issue that is high on the agenda and that might give us greater chances to win funding, we should really start from the challenges that young people experience and their the frames and the way they envisage their vision of social change and start from that in order to build a participatory process. And so perhaps instead of having citizen assembly on climate change, start a dialogue within the community with young people to frame the focus, right? If the problem is climate change, to really reframe it based on the perception and how young people experience it. And so that might be a way to make it less extractive. I don't know what you think about that.
I think that that's great. I think that starting from participants, whether we're talking about young people or anyone, any community members, framing their own problem is essential. I think it's essential. But I think that there's something else that is really key, which is n both the content, so the problem, and the form, right? And how does, I think this is where, if we come back to this question of language and what's the language of academics and of academic institutions and researchers versus the language of people or the language that relates to a specific problem, right? The design of that participatory process, the form is really important. And I don't think that means, I think sometimes I've seen academic institutions say, well, we don't know that language, so we're going to, be totally hands off and say everything should be figured out by the community or by the young people. And I think that's irresponsible also. I think that form is really important to that clarity that Stu was talking about before, right? What are we able to achieve with this project? What are the limitations and the possibilities of this project? Who will be listening and who won't be listening, right? What kinds of resources do we have at our disposal and do we not have? What kinds of time frame? And having, bringing in the sort of opportunities to choose from some models or to understand these are, to be able to not say, okay, we don't, we're gonna the opposite of deciding everything is deciding nothing. So we're gonna decide nothing. I think that's and Stu can help me out here, but I think that's also really problematic, right? And I've seen that even, in elements of the projects that we collaborated on, and sometimes it's really dangerous to say, well, we understand that all the rules about money and pavement have been so restrictive that here's a bunch of money and you decide what to do with it. Like, that's terrible. That no group that hasn't, maybe a group that's been working for years and years and years and has all kinds of processes can deal with something like that. But not young people who've just come together for a few weeks, right? So I think there's really important responsibility to, yes, co-design, but to think about what are the kinds of forms that we think are going to meet this project and how are we offering them in a way that's an offering, but not a sort of abdication of all our responsibilities.
Yeah,
So,
thanks. Thanks.
yeah, go
Yeah,
ahead.
well, you wouldn't be surprised wholeheartedly agree with Katie. The other question is around what's the research for? Is it around seeking the truth, or is it about service change and development? And so, for me, there are two different, uniquely different ways of doing voice work and engagement with children, young people. Also, there's a different tack that you need to follow when producing the research, and when you try to influence the decision makers to make that change happen. And what we know is that that can be quite an arduous, long journey from making change. So I think we timed it on one of our projects in Greater Manchester, and that was 2 years to get through the system. So most research projects haven't got the luxury of that time limit to achieve that. So absolutely around that. The other bits around the kind of the abdicating responsibility. For me, it's always around a partnership between adults and young people. And one of the reasons, if we're going down a rights-based voice or participation practice, then actually it's the responsibility of the adults and the services to carry out the rights for young people. It's not really the responsibility for the young people to jump up and down and demand them, even though we ask them to do that. It's a legal responsibility. So we need to be held to account on that legal responsibility, and there needs to be some accountability to that as well. And the other thing around working in partnership is that if what sometimes happens is, if you do give a blank canvas, people will always refer back to the decisions that they've always made. So part of the role of working with groups and with young people in that way is to open their mind up to the possibility as well, and the art of the possibility. So wouldn't like to be just going there with a blank canvas, because I don't think that ever works. And there should be some scaffolding around that. And we as adults and institutions need to provide some of that scaffolding. Otherwise, it doesn't prepare young people for the real world going forward, because that's not how it works when you become an adult. So there's all of that stuff that's going on. I absolutely agree with Kate. We can't just passport responsibility onto young people. It's kind of a partnership for me. And I strongly talk about the relationships, Sonia. We talk all the time about the importance of the relationships with young people. So for me, that's part of that relationship building cycle as well, that needs to be inherent from the start of any kind of research or engagement project.
No, absolutely.
I just chime in on that one more bit. I think there's something really key there, and what you're saying about relationships with young people and sort of the scaffolding that practitioners or adults or whoever are part of the project are providing. And I think there's something that I always struggle to articulate because it's hard to pinpoint, but there's something about the ethical standards of the human beings involved and their skill and ability to offer scaffolding, take feedback from young people, read the room, and have a back and forth that says, this is what we're offering. How is it being received? Is it moving towards the goals of the young people? Is this absolutely not what's going on, and we need to pull back and start again, or offer something else, or open up a more formless conversation in
Yeah.
this particular instance? And that comes down to practice, right? And that comes down to self-reflection, right? Reflexivity on the space of the practitioners. And I think this is also really important for researchers and for academics to think about, is do they have the experience engaging with community in that way? And if not, maybe they shouldn't be the ones to do it, right? And how do they think about that as a criteria, not just how many things you've published, or in terms of who they're working with, is really their ethical relationship and their history of ethical engagement with community, which again is not that scientific to be able to. And I use the word ethics in a totally different sense than university ethics, right? It's about justice and respect and really sort of believing in the inherent intelligence of the people that we're working with. Yeah.
Brilliant. And this actually nicely brings me to the next questions. What processes then do you think can support young people to be and also enjoy being co-researchers and co-designers of policies and social change on their own terms?
So yeah, I can jump in. I suppose processes that are flexible, I think not kind of as fixed as they possibly are in big institutions. We know from our practice is that the work with young people has to be flexible. If we are looking for active engagement, then the systems and structures and the people involved need to be as flexible as the young people that are taking part. Not only that, because part of their engagement in these programs is that it's voluntary. So therefore, we need to remember that it's not necessarily a job. The young people, they're doing it because they want to do it. And actually, part of that flexibility is to make it fun and enjoyable. No one likes doing stuff that's boring. So why would we do that? The important thing for me is around processes is I think higher education is in a really luxurious position because it has access to resources and knowledge that isn't necessarily readily available in the community. And if there are any processes that are inherent going forward, it is around how that institution wants a long-term relationship with the local community and the organisations in them local communities as well. What we see with some research projects, and I understand because of the nature of education, is that it's kind of used as a dipping toe. Someone will come and research young people and then won't be seen again. They also come and work with the young people and they might make numerous promises which are never going to be fulfilled. So there's something there around how we can develop stronger, longer term relationships between institutions that have a wider benefit for the community. And I know that institutions or academic institutions have desires and visions to do that. Whether that happens, I am not convinced. When I speak to local community members, they still don't know where the university's in their local areas. So there's something there about how we strengthen them relationships going forward.
Yeah, and I think well, obviously I'm all about processes being fun and flexible. I think fun is essential for, all the things I always think about, but for, generating creative solutions to entrenched problems and for making spaces more accessible. But it's also essential for kind of realigning some of the power dynamics that are traditional in institutional spaces, including academic institutional spaces, right? And so through having fun, those kind of formalities of those academic institutions can crumble a little bit and there can be a little bit more equality. And then I think we go to the end of the project, as you're saying, Stu, the research ends, and then there's all these papers. Right. And I have, and I, and unfortunately, I'm still unsure what those papers do for the world other than because I don't, as a practitioner who's very engaged in working on lots and lots of social issues, working on participatory democracy, for one thing, I can't understand most of those articles. And because of that, maybe they don't also cross my desk. They're not coming into my desk, my place, my work life, right? They're staying in this bubble of academia. And so even when we say, let's invite young people to participate in this journal article, I think that the infrastructure, the bureaucracy around those, the rules, the language that they're in really make it very difficult unless the whole thing were to have a huge systems change and it was not to be written in those languages with all those references, with all those things that I've never read, then I think that we're not really going to equal that playing field. So if we're thinking about processes that are fun and joyful to create a little bit more equality, that's great. But again, as you say, what's happening in the long term? Essentially, the community still has the language they use, and the academics still have the language they use. And the academics are going for some goals, which I think, as you say, are essentially knowledge production, and the community is going for concrete change in their daily lives. So this is an essential, these are two essential splits that I think make this kind of long-term working really difficult. And I would challenge the researchers to think more and more and more about what is the purpose of their research beyond the publications and beyond the production of knowledge, which I understand has some, philosophical value, but what, how is that seen in the world in the long term, if that is what's coming out, of these things? And I think that just to go back to your other thing about what do universities have? Why do we participate in these kinds of processes, right? They have the access to money and resources for projects. They also have space, beautiful space sometimes, and rooms, and and all kinds of things, and students to help, and they have people, they have money, they have space. And I think that there's much more to be done to think about how to democratize and how to equalize those resources throughout the life of a project, right? So example, when the projects that we worked with sometimes, it's not okay for young people to enter into these spaces and for the security guard to say, the space is not booked, and to yell at them and to say, you have to leave. It's not okay. It means we didn't do our job. It's not just a mistake, it's a real problem. Right? It's not okay to say we have some money for this, but we're not allowed to pay you in money. We're only allowed to pay vouchers because of, maybe for young people, but I've seen that happen with adults. You can't, big money, you can only pay with gift cards. How do they, that's work. How can they pay their rent, right? Or their gas bill? It's not okay to say we have all this money, but we can't pay you until months and months down the line. Right? Or even to ask practitioners to have to front all that themselves, because the bureaucracy and the rules in these institutions are really inhibiting this kind of real collaboration, and then the outputs are further sort of exacerbating those power dynamics. So those are the things that I think that the universities really have to think very critically about.
I think,
Yeah,
yeah, and
absolutely.
just I was just going to say, and Katie, you wouldn't be surprised, the space thing still hasn't improved in regards to access to the wonderful spaces. And we talked about the Lundy model at the start, Sonia. The first element to engagement on that is space. And whether that's physical or digital, universities have got so much access to it's inhabitable by members of the community. It's a bit of a travesty, really. The other thing I would say around processes is around recognizing young people's voice and research often intertwines, and actually there should be a myriad of opportunities for young people to have their voices heard. And part of that is through formal mechanisms which are in place to hold the decision makers to account, but you need the informal ones, the creative side, to get the engagement of wider community members. So for me, there has to be a conjoined process of both formal and informal voice practice, and that's when you see the best results.
I agree. Do you have an example of a project that helped?
Yeah, so a lot of stuff that we do with things like the Youth Combined Authority, that would be described, I would suggest, as a formal mechanism for children, young people's voice. So it's a representational group where organisations and young people on the organisations get a seat on that group. The activities that go on once we've got the young people in the room are not formal because it's been delivered by youth workers, but the structure is. Where it works best is when young people engage in stuff like the legislative theatre, where it draws out some of the stories from young people, some of the experiences, and then that's been enabled to go on to things like the Youth Combined Authority. So what the young people can do is use the experiences, use the evidence that's coming out from that, and then take it through its formal mechanisms to try and make sure that change is happening. I think what sometimes happens when it's just done through the informal method is that it gives decision makers the opportunity to get off the hook with some of the stuff that's been agreed. And also on the other way around, if it's just done by the formal route, it doesn't have as wider engagement as it possibly could. So for me, the two need to work hand in hand together.
Absolutely. And I guess this partnership between academics and practitioner can create, can we call them boundary spanners, gatekeepers, to start translating, processes and languages and create a more shared space. I guess the aim of a lot of the sort of the ambition of a lot of academics is more in terms of social impact rather than just publication. And but there are a lot of constraints and incentives that takes us in a different direction, and that's something that we really need to reflect on. But I absolutely agree that it's really about building more long-term relationships rather than having short dip into a community without living much behind, except perhaps that the project that might even be very successful, but then doesn't leave the impact that we were envisaging, and
Can I
instead
jump
building
in?
relationship in more in the long term, so that we really center the experience of communities, and then we can really distribute funding and give access to space, etc. And but through that sort of relationship building that is much more grounded in the community. So yeah, a small project won't go very far. It's really about thinking more long-term processes and then building funding along the way, I guess. Well, yeah, and this partnership then become crucial. Sorry, Katie, go ahead.
Sure. No, I was just going to say, I think that there's something really key that Stu said that I don't want to lose, which is about the collaboration from the beginning with the kind of institutional power holders or decision makers and the young people in this case, and the university if it's an academic project. And I that I always, harp on this, but my most successful examples have not been with universities, but for example, the Right to the Streets project with GM Moving and Trafford Council and a whole bunch of young people. It started with very clear goals and outcomes in terms of changes in public policy to make streets and public spaces safer for women and girls. And there was a lot of political pull to put the pressure on the Transport for Greater Manchester, the Parks Department, all of these are institutions to push forward exactly what the young people and their peers and families came up with. And then those changes happened. And that is incredibly powerful. And they're texting each other saying, "Do you see that sign on the tram that's talking about that's interrupting catcalling? And that's what we said. And 2 months later, it's there. And do you see this communications campaign? And we had this whole event about it." And right. And I think that's really important is that there's sort of a historical memory of academic projects that lead nowhere. So when we, no, not nowhere, but nowhere in terms of these kind of long-term social impacts, or not nowhere again, but less where. So when we're inviting these kind of, local leaders, local governments to take part in these processes, I think they see those projects from that lens, just like community groups have a historical knowledge and, experience of university and academic projects as being extractive and exploitative and parachuting in and parachuting out again. So I think that we have to be very serious that if we don't have those decision makers 100% on board. And I think it's actually very dangerous for us to come, for academics to come to those stakeholders with resources and say, "I have a project," because in my experience, it just makes them turn off because they think that it's the same project that's happened over and over and over that's going nowhere. And I think that's the historical kind of harm that I'm talking about, that they just say, "Okay, there's some money, we'll get our name in some report, and we're not going to do anything else because we know how this has gone in the past."
Yeah, I mean, I've got my own views on that in the sense that sometimes you also have to challenge the existing policy agenda, and by co-creating knowledge with the community, you open space for different discourses and then push in the long term for more radical social change, even that wouldn't be engaged with policymakers at that point in time, for instance. But then I think like the relationship building between the institution, the community, yeah, there has to be a relationship of trust, and often within the constraints of a small project that doesn't happen because there is no funding to build relationship and there is no funding to build an infrastructure that can help cement impact afterwards. And so it's down then to this partnership across different sectors to try and build up a process long term by, you know, sort of building funding after funding. But it's incredibly challenging as well. But that actually brings me to the next question about how can we then play a constructive role, you know, in the assumption that we all want to work towards social change and centering the experience of young people, particularly in the case of this participation with children and youth. So how do we see the role of researchers and practitioners in supporting these networks of solidarity with the community and with local institutions? How can we together create space to strengthen youth voice beyond just one project? And so we've addressed a number of challenges and pitfalls, but yeah, how do you see this relationship? Because I think we can all play a role. But how can we do it in a way that sort of enhances the assets of the other partners rather than disempowering them, and particularly the young people?
Yeah, so I suppose that actually was picking up on the last point that Katie said there around historical knowledge as well. So I suppose one of the suggestions that I would say to any institution is do your homework first, understand the local communities that you're not only based within, but the local communities that you're looking to work alongside. And that comes through not only reading books about local areas, but going out and speaking and meeting people, and just as we always say, building relationships. So definitely do the homework. The other thing around doing your homework, find out what services are currently out there with young people, who's got existing relationships, who's working with them, why they're working with them, and what's the kind of need in that local area. And again, part of that kind of do your homework thing is if it is a research program, remember kind of any exit strategy from the start. And there is something there about reaching young people that are engaged, but reaching young people that are not so engaged currently with services. And what's the responsibility of the university to try and support the young people that are disengaged to be more engaged with some of the stuff going on, if that's their choice. So just do homework about local area. The other one is about li linking into existing stuff that's already going on. That's not about replicating. But one of the things that shudders down my spine is when academics come in and give criticism about formal youth voice programs. And I spend huge amounts of my time speaking to people of who characterize the young people in formal voice structures without necessarily having an experience of going to that group or doing any kind of research about that group. Just because it's got the word formal in front of it or it's got youth forum, there's an academic snobbery to the way it works without a realization that actually most youth forums are delivered by youth workers that are paid not to work with engaged young people, advantage young people, but quite the opposite actually. So by default, you are reaching the right young people. So linking into existing stuff. The other thing I'd say about academic institutions is support your VCSE sector as well. There's some great stuff that already goes on. And again, Kate used the word parachuting. We've probably experienced so much parachuting of big services coming in. Actually, there's some really wonderful stuff that happens on a street-based grassroots level with just a little bit of extra support could grow and flourish. So again, yeah, that would be That would be my bit. The other bit is of course, be open-minded and don't overpromise. Young people don't say that they're going to change the world, because it's inevitably change takes time. And actually, Kate gave a really good example there of the work that went on prior to starting some of them programs to make sure that the mechanisms of change were already in place before the actual engagement starts. So again, that's a really important bit as well. And I'll stop now, Katie.
Yeah, I agree with all of those things you said, Stu. I think I would ask academia to sort of recognize its privilege the same way that grown-ups need to recognize our privilege, white people need to recognize our privilege, kind of, just be start by being more power aware of the power that they hold in all of these conversations, I mean, kind of just so many examples again from my own experience of being treated badly by, so many. I mean, so once a week or 2 weeks, some academics write to me and say, some strangers, we already wrote you into a project to this extent, X, Y, and Z. Will you sign off? It's due tonight.
Oh my God.
And then, one that I spent months working on with some academics. They never reported what the result was, and I had to chase, and they said, "Oh, we didn't get it." And I said, "You don't even tell the partners that you had 10 meetings with." Like, these are the kinds of things. If this is what they're doing to other adults, that's just a tiny bit. And I know we're supposed to think about what you should do, but what you should do is none of that stuff, right? So like thinking about the situation in which you're meeting the people that you're working with. What is the situation in which these young people are living right now? What will it be like thinking ahead to walk into this building and not have a room and be yelled at by the security guard, right? What will it be like for the organization to be put all these demands on and not be able to get their money for months and months, right? For the charity partner, for the VCSE sector. So I think it's about the academics really recognizing their privilege and then figuring out how to articulate, this goes back to the beginning of our conversation, exactly what they think the impact of this research can be. This is my deep question for so many projects, and I'm often unsatisfied with how they're able to answer. What do they think it can be? And then, as you said at the beginning, Stu, figuring out how to be absolutely clear and transparent and honest about that with everybody involved from beginning to end. So if the whole goal of this project is about opening up our imaginations, then let's just say that, right? That whatever it is, and if that's what we're going to do, you're going to do with your journal article, we're going to do with our public events, we're going to do with our informal sessions with young people, that's all it is, right? So let's figure out, and I guess that's the thing, again, going back, how can we find the center of the Venn diagram where there's something that everybody is working towards, and then really hold on to that, and again, be honest and truthful with each other when there's some challenge or barrier to that in relation to the institutions that we're working with. That's the beginning. Yeah.
That's excellent. I think we could close with a two, three practical suggestion. I think you've already covered a lot, but if we wanted to summarize like two or three bullet points or things that both researchers and practitioners working with young people really need to keep in mind, top of their list when they're even starting to think about how to work with young people and engage with them for social change.
So I'm going back to our start that conversation around rights, be rights based from the beginning, and also consider that in all of the practice, whether that's through the research, to the groups, to the responsibility that it's a legal requirement, it would be rights based. So yeah, the rights based one, and then I'll re-emphasize stuff that I said around understanding and doing your homework of the communities that you want to work with and alongside. And last one, don't use them, work with.
Excellent. Katie, would you like to share?
I guess, being humble and related to that, thinking about power at all times and power dynamics. And, if we're prioritizing fun and joyfulness, as ways to shift those power dynamics, think about how that that spirit of fun and joyfulness and of redistributing power continues through the long-term work of the academic institution and not just at the moment of the community project. I mean, those would be just a few.
That's great. And I mean, from my perspective, what I've learned, and I've learned so much from working with you and Stu and the other partners and the young people in our previous project, is that any project that aims to social change or social impact really has to start with the needs and but also the assets and the capabilities of the participants, and particularly the young participants and their communities. And definitely building rather than bypassing or replicating what is already happening, and use our funding to support what is already there and is already good and has a chance to embed in the long term beyond just one small project. And I think that the participatory research and the participatory the various creative methods can help really bring to the forefront the young participants' own vision of what policy and social change they actually want. With our support, but I agree that total honesty and transparency about the limitation of impact are absolutely crucial conversation to have from the start. And I think, as I said, this can never really be done fully within a small project. So it really requires a commitment with work and embed with the same communities over the long term. And that would be my advice to participatory researchers in particular, that parachuting in and out is just not gonna leave much to the communities you're working with. I don't know if you want to add anything else, but thank you so much for your time and for sharing your experience and your wisdom. And I hope people will respond to this conversation and will start developing more constructive partnership across the different sectors, because we really need each other.